Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. The U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs may be the second largest federal agency, but it runs the largest medical system in the United States, providing care to 6 million veterans and their families who depend on it. This is no small feat considering the demands placed on the system. To meet these demands head-on involves leveraging innovation and advances in technology. Dr. Peter Levin, Senior Advisor to the Secretary and Chief Technology Officer at VA, explains his role and mission to identify new technologies and promote innovation.
I get to ask the hard questions. I get to ask the risky questions. I get to fail, right, in ways that sometimes other folks wouldn't feel comfortable with or, frankly, wouldn't feel empowered. So the first thing that I do, there's a sign on my door. It says, all people who need empowerment find it here. The first answer out of my mouth is yes. And then we figure out how to get what it is that folks are asking for. This is a direct instruction from Secretary Shinseki. In literally my first day on the job, he pulls all the new political guys, especially the guys he didn't know well. We were new to him at that time. And he says, look, here's the deal. I'm the only guy in the administration who can say no. I'm the only guy in the agency who can say no, right? So your job is to say yes. And that's, I tell you, that's a mission I take pretty seriously. So the CTO role is about exploring the boundaries of new technology. It's about exploring the boundaries of new problems, problems that some folks say, well, you just have to live with that. You just have to suffer underneath it, or you just have to kind of ignore it and hope it goes away. I get to say, well, geez, why is it that we don't have automated claim system? Why is it that veterans can't get their electronic medical records? Why is it that we don't have suicide prevention chat line for the folks that don't feel comfortable or don't want to call the agency? And then we can start walking through those questions. That's about half of my job. The other half of my job is serving, I would say, as a traditional senior advisor role, confidential actions, personnel issues, making sure that the boss is well prepped for whatever meeting that he has.
Here's Dr. Peter Levin outlining his approach to identifying technology and innovation.
So the way that I approach this, at least, is when somebody brings me a new opportunity, when somebody brings me a problem, I try to fit it into a framework, right? I try to say, okay, so is this a device issue which becomes a hardware issue, which becomes a qualification issue? Or is this a data liquidity issue which becomes an access issue, which becomes a quality of service issue, right? And I can sort of walk you through maybe 6 or 7 of those opportunities where I have this framework that I've been able to assemble and accumulate over, gosh, you know, 30 years now, right? The next thing I like to do is I like to feed it back. I can map practically any problem you throw at me somewhere in that framework and connect it to things that either that I know that are going on already at the VA or that I know that are going on in the private sector. It's been a huge benefit to me, and I'd like to think that it's been one of the secrets, one of the ways that we've been able to move the ball forward a little bit.
Levin explains how he has sought to enhance the delivery of VA's mental health services.
This is a project that was actually spearheaded by Jan Kemp and by Sonia Batten, two people who I consider sort of my closest collaborators at VA. Now, suicide, as you might know, is an endemic problem in the United States right now, right? It's not particular to veterans. But when veterans have this problem, it's something that we can do something about as long as they're in our system, as long as we can touch them, as we know who they are, they have to identify themselves. Jan had this idea to create a chat service. And she said, well, look, we have this capability. The technology is there. It's not very expensive and it's highly secure. But she was being blocked, you know, by the bureaucracy and by the qualifications and the certifications. So the first project that I worked on, literally in the first month, I can tell you the day that we went live. It was July 3rd, 2009. And we turned on that internet chat service. And fast forward to today, we have over 6,000 interventions, right? Now, that's, I'm not talking about just the chats that we have every time somebody, you know, misdialed us or, you know, they weren't, let me say, weren't looking for suicide prevention services. They were looking for something else. But nothing is more important to me than those couple of folks that are with their families today because of what Jan did a couple of years ago and where I got to kind of help push it across the goal line a little bit.
Dr. Peter L. Levin is a serious proponent of VA using open source technology to meet its mission.
I'll tell you why we do open source, because we're more secure and because it's cheaper in the long run. Okay. Now, what does that actually, how does that translate into what we're doing at the VA? Translates in a lot of ways. Mostly in the area of electronic health records, right? The claims processing piece, it ends up, it seems surprising. You can always use open source components. You can use open source front ends. You can use open source operating systems. There are all kinds of places where it finds purchase there.
It is critical to the safety and security of this country that federal, state, local, private sector, and international partners improve their sharing of information about terrorism, homeland security, and weapons of mass destruction. When examining the full scope of information sharing and protection, many widespread and complex challenges must be addressed and solved by multiple agencies and organizations working together. Smedra Paul, Program Manager of the Information Sharing Environment, describes for us the ISE.
The ISE is a complicated topic. The way I think about it is that the ISE is a collection of normalized mission and technical capabilities distributed and decentralized across all of our mission partners, federal, state, local, tribal, and private sector entities. The ISE is delivered by interconnecting existing networks, systems, and databases, working with industry and standards bodies to adopt required standards and other frameworks. The ISE harmonizes and standardizes information processes based on shared mission equities. And finally, the ISE strengthens information safeguardings, including protecting privacy, civil liberties, and civil rights of the American people. A practical way of thinking about the ISE is to think of it as an information analog to the interstate highway system. The same way the interstate highway system knit together this country post-World War II, the ISE is intended to be the information fabric enabling whole-of-government responses to national security and public safety challenges that face our nation.
Smedra Paul outlines the history and evolving mission of his office.
My office is a core part of the government's response post-9/11. From our inception, our office has had a particular focus in two areas. First, the domestic information sharing architecture, really the nexus between public safety and national security, which some in the law enforcement community talk about in terms of the nexus between homeland security and hometown security. Second, our office has had a focus on identifying, integrating, and disseminating best practices around responsible information sharing, management, and integration, really a direct line from the government reform efforts around information resources management that were anticipated with legislation like Clinger-Cohen, the eGov Act of 2002, FISMA, the Privacy Act, and other related legislation.
In meeting his mission, Smedra Paul faces significant challenges.
The number one issue is 11 years post-9/11, retaining the urgency and prioritization of accelerating responsible information sharing. That's the, kind of our number one challenge. We've had a lot of progress. We've made progress. Last year, at the 10-year anniversary, commentators inside, outside of the government all recognized the progress we've made on information sharing post-9/11. But there's more work to do, and it requires focus and prioritization. The number two challenge is new, and it's just as big as the structural financial challenge faced by agencies in the public sector. It's bad at the federal level. It's much worse at the state and local level. Number three is the evolving and increasingly integrated threats that span national security and public safety missions. And four is the tsunami of information and the imperative to correlate disparate bits of information across the distributed ISE. There's lots of data.
Setting standards are critical to the ISE. Smedra Paul also underscores that pursuing standards hardly limits or defeats innovation. In fact, they're complementary.
We absolutely believe that standards enable innovation. The key here is let's innovate where we should innovate. Let's innovate where we can add value. And let's standardize where we have defined requirements and have common mission equities, and we really need to share information. So our standards framework is really focused on exchange standards. It's standards on the edges of organizations. And it's really trying to solve the problem of moving from point to point. So standards are critical to empowering the ISE, and we think the nexus with the standards work is work with industry and standards organizations.
You are listening to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, highlighting the fall-winter 2012, the Business of Government magazine. Next up, profiles in leadership. I've interviewed a variety of government executives who manifest the leadership and commitment needed to meet their varied missions. In this edition, we introduce you to three leaders who are changing the way government does business. They are indeed profiles in leadership, and here's a glimpse. Richard Boley directs the Office of E-Diplomacy within the U.S. Department of State, and he's charged with making e-diplomacy the way to collaborate within the department.
So really the nub of e-diplomacy is to make sure that if somebody has the information that another person needs to get their work done, that they can find each other. It's not this hierarchical command and control knowledge management approach where there's some gigantic data basement somewhere where everything needs to be thrown and you go fishing for the information there. It's more that information is where it is, and you just need it to make it discoverable. To facilitate access to the information that a diplomat or our State Department employees need anytime, anywhere on any of our available platforms. And so that's kind of the real nub of it. But part of it is, although I don't like the idea of cultural change, there is a change implicit in this. If we move from a Cold War need-to-know approach where the idea, the watchword was keep information locked down, siloed, because the big bad Soviet bear was out there trying to get pieces and aggregate them to figure out our secrets. And you fast forward to the post 9/11 era where we found ourselves crippled by our inability to aggregate those same pieces of information to identify our threats and vulnerabilities. So that sea change, that change from need to know to need to share, is fundamental to what we do. Equally fundamental is the idea that success is not dependent on the information you hoard, but the ability to articulate the information you have across an important, valuable network throughout the enterprise, not just to the people you know, but people who may be a degree or two of separation away from you, but would benefit from having access to the information you have.
According to Richard Boley, it's about identifying better ways to find and share information and to network, thus enabling and encouraging State Department personnel to securely and effectively contribute knowledge anywhere at any time.
Out of that was born e-diplomacy, which was an effort to put end users in the IT decision-making process and help us develop platforms for collaboration and information sharing really from the grassroots.
The department's ability to maintain institutional knowledge has always been a challenge, given that foreign service assignments typically last 2 years. This makes it even more critical to maintain institutional memory, foster collaboration, and cultivate connections within the department.
Every time that we make a gain, how can we institutionalize that gain so that it doesn't become, the barnacle that gets scraped off the ship when some new leadership comes in, but it becomes woven into the very fabric of how we do diplomacy. Again, getting back to solving problems, we find that that's the best way to institutionalize something. When somebody finds that something, a platform that we've developed, helps them get their job done better, faster, quicker, and more efficiently, they become the advocates for the work that we're doing. And so we really try to have as many people come to that aha moment and move over the hump that always happens when you move to something new.
The importance of harnessing technology and maturing it according to the needs of those it serves cannot be overstated.
And we always say it's not about the technology. The technology, it should never be the focus. The focus should be what is the end user trying to achieve and can we achieve it faster, easier, better through the right tool for the right challenge.
We'll continue with the Business of Government magazine when this special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns.